Jesus, write on my heart every word. Tell me the story most precious, sweetest that ever was heard. Seated, please.
We do have so many visitors today, and that's something for which we're very grateful. In fact, we have some of our former members who've come back. Sarah Campbell is with us. We're glad to have her back. And Dr. Karen Sargent and her family and her baby and I think her in-laws and her husband. And is that your father with you from East Texas, who was such a friend of this church when Karen was in medical school? So glad to have you. Before I introduce the speaker, I want to encourage you to stay for about 40 minutes to listen to the report that our great friend and missionary will present on her work this year in North Ireland and other places. Marianna Long is the most experienced missionary, I think, that we have in our brotherhood, especially if you were to consider the women. If I lived in the first century when the Bible was written, and I had a chance to meet and to listen to Phoebe, who was called the servant of the church, that's one person I'd want to hear. I'd want to meet her. So I hope that our visitors will get a chance to meet Marianna after our service, and we'll have the presentation in the side room here. Today we're especially happy to have Dr. Joe Barnett to speak for us. He has been my closest friend, and one of the things that I'm most happy about in my ministry here is to acquaint Joe Barnett with this church and this church with Joe Barnett. He doesn't accept speaking engagements very often. Probably now only about two churches does he fill in for in preaching, and one of them is the Broadway congregation, because he's come to love this church as I have. He has had a most amazing career. He was the preacher at the Broadway Church of Christ in Lubbock, where some of our members were converted and attended when they were students at Texas Tech. And in the 12 years, he was the minister there from 1968 to 1980. It grew to be the largest Church of Christ in the world. And then the big shock that I and everybody else had, in 1980, he announced his resignation from Broadway to devote himself to writing. He had started Pathway Evangelism several years before, in 1972, and he decided to give up the local church in Broadway and to devote himself to writing. He says, and I believe it's true, that he prefers writing on Christian subjects more than he does preaching. Every day, every single day, in 50 nations of the world, people open their computers or their phones and they get Pathway Evangelism and his message for that day. Thousands of people every day share that experience. I know for me, that's the first thing that I do in the mornings when I am getting ready for work, is the first thing is that I read his message on Pathway Evangelism. If you do not receive that, if you'll let me know, we'll get you signed up today. It doesn't cost anything, and it's the most wonderful blessing in your life. We're very privileged to have today Joe Barnett as our speaker.
I recently heard of a man who was moving into a senior citizen's residential place. And when he was in the lobby filling out his paperwork, he looked across the room and he saw a woman there that was just staring at him. When he finished his paperwork, he went out by the pool to make a telephone call, and he saw that same woman across from the pool, and she was staring at him. He went into the dining hall for his lunch, and while he was eating lunch, he looked across the room, and he saw that woman, and she was staring at him. When he finished his lunch, he walked over to her and he said, "Do I know you?" He said, "I don't recall ever seeing you before, but seems like you keep looking at me and I'm wondering why." And she said, "Well, you look like my fourth husband." And he said, "Oh." He said, "How many times you've been married?" And she said, "3. There's a woman in my apartment complex that told me that story a couple of Sunday afternoons ago. And she said that her preacher had told that story that morning at church. And we laughed. And I said, "What was your preacher's text this morning?" And she said, "I don't know." And I said, "Well, what was his topic? What did he preach about?" And she said, "I don't remember." Now, she was only 3 or 4 hours removed from that service, but she didn't remember any of that. Those of us who preach always hope that people hear what we say. And secondly, we hope that they remember what they heard. And long, long experience teaches us that neither of those things usually happen. And I just want you to know I'm aware of it. And I'm okay with it. But in spite of that, you continue to let me come here. And I'm so grateful for that. I love this church. And you've been so good to me through the years. And I appreciate it so much. And it is always such an honor to stand in this place where your longtime minister, Alan Isbell, so often has stood. And I consider that a very great honor, and I don't take it lightly. So thank you for letting me do that. Thank you, Alan. Thank you. You know, the Pharisees and Sadducees were uncompromising enemies. They agreed on almost nothing. But there was one exception to that. They reached across the aisle in bipartisan cooperation in one case: destroy Jesus. Destroy Jesus. You have a snapshot of that in Matthew chapter 22. You see, first of all, the Pharisees who are going after him. And that encounter is found in verses 15 through 22. And then the Sadducees came after him. And that encounter is in verses 23 through 33. In each of those cases, they were confronting Jesus with a question that they considered to be unanswerable. And in each of those cases, he countered their unquestionable question with an unanswerable answer. When the Pharisees saw that he had put the Sadducees to silence, they took another shot at it. You find that in verses 34 through 36, and I want to spend a little more time on that one. When they found that they could not beat him, and when they found that the Sadducees could not beat him, they recruited an expert in the law to try to trap him. And that expert in the law stood up and he asked him a question. He said, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" That appears to be a totally unanswerable question. They had 613 laws. 613. And those rabbis were constantly debating all of those various commandments. And they were measuring them, which is great, which is small, which is important, which is not so important. Cornering Jesus into naming one of those 613 seemed sure to trap him. No matter which one he prioritized, he was going to offend somebody. You can't please them all. Read the letters to the editor tomorrow morning. You just can't please them all. And so it was almost certain that whatever he said was going to create division. And that's exactly what they were after. But Jesus immediately quoted the one commandment that was most familiar to them, because it was the commandment that was at the beginning of every synagogue service. And for every practicing Jew, it was the commandment that they quoted every morning when they first got out of bed and every evening right before they went to bed. It was the first text that every Jewish child committed to memory. It was called the Shema. Deuteronomy chapter 6, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." Jesus said that's the greatest and the first commandment. And then he said, and a second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. This expert in the law was asking for one great commandment. Jesus gave that to him, and then he added from Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. You know, the way to know that you're loving God with all your being is to test how you treat other people. Love for God means coming to see other people as God sees them. And every person is loved by God. Now in Luke chapter 10, we come across this Shema statement again. It's a totally different setting, and it's a different person who quotes it. In the first instance, Jesus quoted it. In the second, it's another expert in the law. Because this time, the expert in the law came to Jesus to test him. And he said, "What must I do to have eternal life?" And Jesus said, in essence, "Well, you're an expert in the law. You answer that question. What does the law say? How do you read it?" And that lawyer said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said, "That's it. Do it and you'll live." That wasn't quite enough for this lawyer. The text says that he wanted to justify himself, so he said, "Yes, I got that, but who is my neighbor? Who deserves that kind of treatment and love from me?" So Jesus told a story. It's one of his best known parables. You know it as the parable of the Good Samaritan. And Jesus pointed to a road that led from Jerusalem to Jericho. It was a treacherous stretch of road, sometimes called the Bloody Pass. And he said a man was traveling down that road and he got mugged. And they took everything that he had and they beat him and they left him half dead. We're not told anything about that man. Seems a little strange, doesn't it? But we're not told anything about it. We don't know his name. We don't know his occupation. We don't know his nationality or his religion. I mean, it's probably safe to assume that he was a Jew, but we're not told anything about him that makes him either worthy or unworthy. He's just a generic human being. And Jesus said some professional religionists came down that road and saw that man. One of those was a priest. And he scampered to the other side of the road and passed by. We're not told why. We can conjecture a little bit. It may very well be that he had an assignment in Jerusalem, that he was going to be doing clergy duty. That only happened twice a year. And so he wouldn't want to lose that rotation. But if he had been close to a dead body, he would lose that rotation because he would be considered unclean for 7 days. Maybe that's the reason he retreated to the other side of the road. And then he said a Levite came by. All priests were Levites, not all Levites were priests. But he was nevertheless a professional religionist, and for whatever reason, he too passed by on the other side of the road. And then Jesus said a third person came by, and he was a Samaritan. A Samaritan. The last person that you would expect to stop and help if this was a Jew. Because Jews hated the Samaritans. Consider them half-breeds, half Jew, half Gentile. In that day, if you wanted to call a person a really bad name, you just call him a Samaritan. That's how they were thought of. But he stopped and he helped. He had some wine, he had some oil. Those were considered medications. He had some material that he could use for bandaging. He had a donkey. He had some money in his pocket. And so he went to that man and he helped him out the best he could. Put him on his donkey, took him into town, took him to an inn, paid his fare, watched over him all night long. And then the next morning when it was time for him to pass on to wherever he was going, he told the innkeeper, "Here's some money. I want you to take care of this man. And I want you to run a tab. And if what I've given you here isn't enough to take care of him, when I come back through, I'll make up the difference. But I want you to take care of him." Now, Jesus asked this expert in the law, "Which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?" And the lawyer said, "Well, the one who had mercy on him." And Jesus said, "I agree. You go and do likewise." Jesus is doing two things here, people. He's doing two things that, in my judgment, we have usually missed, at least I have, and give new meaning to this parable. In the first case, he redefined love. He removed love from a place of feeling to a place of action. From a place of feeling something to a place of doing something. It's highly unlikely that he had any feeling for this injured man. But he did something. He helped him. The second thing is that he redefined who the neighbor was. When he asks this question, who is my neighbor, what do you think of? I always think of that guy in the ditch. That he's saying, whoever needs my help, that's my neighbor. And I think you can make a case from that, but you can't make that case from this story. Because when that lawyer asked, who is my neighbor? And Jesus told this story, he said, which of the three do you think was a neighbor to that man? The priest, the Levite, the Samaritan? Which of these three was a neighbor? In other words, he is saying the neighbor is not the person who needs the help, it's the person who gives the help. In other words, according to this story, if you're asking who is my neighbor, Jesus is saying, it's you. You're the neighbor. You're the one. He's saying the neighbor is you. He changed the question from who is my neighbor to what kind of a neighbor are you? What kind of a person are you? Who is my neighbor doesn't depend upon that person deserving your love. It depends on what you do. I think we have a little trouble coming to terms when Jesus says, love your enemies. How in the world do we pull that off? That seems like an impossible command, doesn't it? Love your enemy. But from this story, we learn that the bottom line is that love is not something you feel. Love is something you do. Jesus did not say, like your enemy. He said, love your enemy. You're not going to like your enemy. But in the biblical sense, you can love your enemy. When Jesus said, love your enemies, in that Sermon on the Plain, he showed that love is something you do. Love your enemies, he said, and he followed that by three things that would define that love. Number one, do good to those who hate you. Number two, ask God to bless those who curse you. Number three, pray for those who mistreat you. Love is something you do. It's not something that happens to you. It's something that you make happen. It's a matter of letting the action precede the feeling instead of demanding that the feeling precede the action. When we think about love, we think about somebody who causes us to love them. That's not what Jesus says here. Matthew chapter 25, when Jesus was talking about those who were going to come out well at the time of judgment, he said, I was hungry and thirsty and sick and without clothes, and you told me that I was in your thoughts and prayers. No. 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 He said, you gave me food and drink and clothes. It wasn't something you felt. It was something that you did. Jesus' definition of love is that you pour in the oil and the wine. You apply the bandages. You put him on your donkey. You take him to the inn. You take care of him. The fact is that showing love is something that I can make happen. It's something that I initiate. It is not something that I have to wait for until somebody makes me deserve their love. The late Dr. Harold Hazlip told me one day about a colleague of his who was a marriage counselor. And he told about a lady who came to his office one day after several years of marriage, and she said, "My husband and I have absolutely nothing in common. Nothing. We're going in opposite directions constantly. I like the arts. He likes sports. I like to travel. He loves the couch and TV. We don't agree on anything. We come out at opposite ends, whatever we're discussing, whatever it happens to be. And I don't see any hope for this marriage. I don't see anything at the end of this marriage but divorce, and that's what I want." What do you say to somebody like that? How do you help in a case like that? Well, he said to this lady, "Before you throw in the towel and call it quits, I wish you'd do one thing. For 30 days, I'd like for you to think about what your husband likes and what he doesn't like and what pleases him and what displeases him. You've been with him long enough to know that. And so for 30 days, do only those things that he likes and that please him. Not to manipulate him, not to control him, not to, in the end of this thing, get your way with him, but just to bring him joy. Just give it a try for 30 days and see if there's any hope at the end of that period of time." Well, she left that session without any promise of commitment to his counsel. She gave no indication of what she was going to do. Sometime after that 30 days had passed, she came back into his office and she said, "You know, when I came to see you, I had so many bad feelings. It had been so long since I even cared about what pleased or what displeased him. And I had to work through a whole lot of negative thoughts before I could even try what you were talking about, but I finally decided to do it. And I began doing things that he liked as often as I could. I did things that would please him as often as I could. I tried to stay away from things that he disliked and that displeased him. And after a few days, he came to me and he looked at me and he said, 'What's going on? What's happened to you? You're a different person.' And so I told him what I was doing. I told him what you had suggested and that that was what I was doing, and he walked away and didn't say a word. Strange thing happened. He started doing things that pleased me, things that I liked, stayed away from those things that had caused all of our problems. And you know, during the last few weeks, something pretty incredible has happened. Both of us have begun enjoying doing what each other like. We still have our issues, but we have something to work with. And you know, I'm kind of beginning to like the old boy." Love is something you do. I think most times feelings will flow out of the action, but they do not have to precede the action. You know what God wants from you most of all? He wants you to love him with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. More than anything, that's what he wants from you. How do you develop that kind of feeling? You know, H.G. Wells was one of the most prominent unbelievers of the 20th century. The last book that he wrote, it's been a century ago, it was in the 1920s. It was called Mind at the End of Its Tether. And in that book, H.G. Wells labeled God the antagonist. He pictured God as someone who was set against man. Now, to see God as the antagonist, of course, is the ultimate distortion, because he loved the world so much that he did something. He gave his son. Love is something you do. And that's the way he proved his love for us when we were sinners, enemies. He gave his son. How can you develop that love for God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength? How about trying for 30 days in everything you do to please him? Run every decision through the filter. Is this something that will be pleasing to God and something that he wants? I have a feeling that a strong feeling will come from that. But that feeling doesn't have to precede your action. Will you try it? For 30 days? Will you? And if there's a chance that you need some help with that, that would help by making some kind of a public response, Alan will be here at the front, and you can simply come to the front while we sing this final song. Let's stand, please, together and sing.